there's something about that horse, Buster. You know, it's like we looked at each other, and then there was eye contact, and I was looking at the horse, and the horse was looking at me, and then it hit me. I think, maybe, I was a centaur in my past life.
Well, something tells me you probably were never half man, half horse, but hell, what do I know?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Dude, I think it was a centaur in my past life. It totally occurred to me.
What makes you think you're half man, half horse?
Charlie.
Come on, out. He's working.
Enjoy the roll.
He's working.
Bro, will you please get out of here? You smell like cheese.
No.
You do smell like...
It's horse.
Well, whatever it is, it's terrible, okay?
Well, let's call it what it is. It's horse.
Charlie, let's go. Get up. Well, the horse was eating a lot of cheese then. I don't know what it is. Just you stink.
Come on, get up.
Now, in your time around, we talked about you trying to feed the meat to the horses. Have you ever, have your horses ever shown any sort of, like, troubling aggression like this?
No, I have spoken to victims.
Yeah.
And, this is interesting. When I, when I talked to you in 2011, I had finished the book, and in the book is a story about a horse called Freight Train. And back in the 1950s, this girl, she's a mature woman now in her 70s, but she was 10 or 11 years old. She was at a riding stable, and she said that she watched this horse at the riding stable walk behind a mother duck. And as the mother duck was walking and the ducklings were walking behind it, Freight Train walked up and ate the ducklings one at a time. Bam, bam, bam. Just ate them up.
Whoa.
And she was just horrified by that. And meanwhile, just recently, last few months or so, there was a video released on YouTube showing a horse walking along, eating a line of ducklings. So, you know, these things are happening. More stuff is coming out as you know, you and I are talking.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy. It's just pretty remarkable. Like I said, as you said, you know, it seems like more people are kind of waking up to this idea, or at least being more cognizant of it, you know, the possibility.
Well, the thing is that a lot of this is cultural. I had a conversation, an email exchange with a man in Nepal who said, well, what's the problem? I said, well, you know, I'm sorry, but in America, they don't understand or they don't believe that horses can consume flesh or fat or offal or blood. And he wrote back and said, oh, I'm sorry, but, you know, it's been pretty routinely known that, you know, you can feed a horse meat here. Because they're, depending on the climate and what's available, this has a lot to do with what the horse eats. There's a famous French long rider. His name was Gabriel Bonvalot, and he made a wonderful trip from Paris to Hanoi in the 1890s. And he went overland through Russia, and he hired some Siberians. And when he got into Tibet, it was so cold that the Siberians begged to go home. Okay?
Oh, wow.
How cold it was. So anyway, he was going along and he met Tibetans who were riding meat-eating horses, and their horses were fully trained to eat meat, and that's something that the climate forced on them.
Yeah. And what I find is interesting is we've talked about this before, but again, it's like it's been 7 years since we talked originally, so I have no problem rehashing old ground. and that's that these horses that eat the meat, they sort of take on sort of different, a little bit more aggression, right? I mean, it's almost like a circular thing in a sense, where it's like if you develop a meat eating horse,
no,
there's a chance it could turn murderous.
No.
No?
No.
Oh, I thought you were saying before that it sort of like improves their, makes them aggressive in a sense.
No. No, I'm not saying that. No.
I'm mistaken.
We know, we got apples and oranges here.
Yeah.
Okay. We know that horses attack human beings. Okay, that's a concept. Okay, you know, we have to move away from the fact that horses are peaceful herbivores, okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, horses can be potentially murderous. That's one idea. Now, we also have to accept the concept that horses are capable of omnivorous dietary habits. Okay?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the ways that we know this is thanks to National Geographic. Okay? Because back in 1951, National Geographic made this amazing accidental discovery that they didn't figure this out. What had happened was is that the communist Chinese had taken power in the East, and they were pushing their way west to what used to be called Turkestan. And the CIA had an agent out there, his name was Douglas McKiernan, and he had been sent out to what's now Western China to plant secret detectors because the United States was worried that Russia was trying to create a nuclear bomb. And so he had planted underground detection devices. But as the communists started moving further and further west, McKiernan realized that he had to flee, and the only way he could get out was to go to Tibet, okay? And meanwhile, an American graduate student named Frank Besek showed up at the consul, and McKiernan and Besek and a Russian, a white Russian, they fled on horseback and towards Tibet. And when they reached the Taklamakan Desert, they were mounted on special meat-eating horses. These horses had been trained to eat meat so that they could cross the desert and get across this place with no pasture.
Yeah.
But it didn't make them aggressive. They just had this capability, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so then McKiernan and Besek reached Tibet, and unfortunately McKiernan was shot and he was beheaded.
Yes.
He was the first CIA guy killed in the field. But now what's interesting is that National Geographic reported on the subsequent migration of this entire tribe. When the communists continued to press westward, these people called the Cossacks, they decided, okay, that's it, we're out of here. So the entire tribe of 10,000 people got all their camels and sheep and goats and horses, and they fled to Kashmir. And those people rode on meat-eating horses. That's how they crossed over the deserts. And National Geographic wrote about that back in 1951, about meat-eating horses. But nobody twigged at the time to this.
Interesting.
And since I've talked to you last time, I have been in contact with a famous British explorer named John Hare. And he's the world's expert with Bactrian camels. And he interviewed some of the Cossacks that actually rode those horses and then came out and settled in India. So, the evidence is there. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the horse becomes aggressive.
So not necessarily aggressive, but I guess that's where I was confused. But if you do feed a horse, didn't you say before that they like sort of they get more? I don't know. They get stronger or more hardy.
Wait a minute. You're thinking if you take a 16-year-old boy and you pump him full of steroids. Okay.
Yeah.
He's going to get really big muscles, and he's also going to become hyper aggressive.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Okay, now that's not exactly what happens because, for example, when the Nazis filmed the Tibetan post horse drink and eat the blood and the barley mix, the horse just walked off and shook himself and went to his stable. Okay, so the diet doesn't necessarily have a link to the violence. There are two largely unknown things about the equine that most modern humans don't understand or believe exist. And I think that's what we need to get across.
Yeah.
It's not that I'm trying to prove it because I don't have any reason to prove it. You know, this isn't like religion. I don't have a dog in this fight, if you see where I'm coming from. I'm not trying to prove anything.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's like a million, there's countless stories here you've told over the years on the show and today that about horses being aggressive. So there should be no debate about that. I mean, that's a fact. I mean, I don't know what people,
No, there is a debate.
I guess you're right. Yeah. I'm just convinced, so I don't think there is.
It all goes back to the beginning of Dudley Equines. And what happened was is that in the book, I explained how what interested me originally was I saw a letter to the editor. And it was a letter written to the editor of The Horse magazine, which is a very prominent American, still widely read American magazine. And this perplexed American horse owner had said that he had witnessed a horse in an act of aggression, and, you know, could they explain? And they wrote back and said, no, we don't have any explanation for it. I, you know, they didn't call this person a liar or say he was delusional, but they just wrote it off. And so as all this stuff started accumulating, because then that's when you could start to detect a pattern.
Yeah.
You could actually detect two patterns. And some places, like Yakutia, they in northern Siberia, they've always known what horses can do. Their perception hasn't changed any. They see horses as they describe horses as our brother wearing a different shirt. That's how they see it.
Interesting.
Okay? Yeah, that's right. It's interesting because they don't see themselves as being that different. They also don't use harsh language with horses. They don't use crops or spurs. And, of course, you know, their survival in minus 60-degree weather depends on the horse. But they also eat horses in that culture, you see?
That's wow.
That's another big taboo. I mean, have you ever eaten horse?
No, not that I know of.
Okay, right. All right. Okay, so you've never eaten a horse. Do you know anybody in America who has ever sat down and went, wow, I'm going to have horse for dinner?
No, I've never met anybody like, yeah, I'm not, I don't know anyone who's ever said that.
Do you know why?
Why?
Because of the Pope.
Because
of the Pope and the Vikings. Because in 732, I think it was 732 AD, there was a religious conflict going on in Western Europe, and Roman Catholicism was exerting a larger and larger influence towards the northwest of Europe. They were moving out of Rome, out of Italy, across the Alps, further and further north, and they were encountering cultural and strong religious resistance from the Norse, the Swedes, the Danes, the Swedes and the Danes,
yeah,
and the Vikings themselves. And Nordic religion had a really important part was to celebrate by sacrificing a stallion and by eating horse meat. And so in Judaism, for example, and Islam, it's against the religious laws to eat pork. Okay, so nobody, you know, Muslims don't eat pig meat.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that. Well, what most people have forgotten is why there is a tradition now in North America and in England still where they don't eat horses. And that's because to combat the influence of paganism, the Pope passed a religious edict saying that no Christian could eat horse meat.
Huh.
And that's where that came from. It was a religious taboo. It's not cultural. It's religious. And it was imposed by the Pope, and he sent a bishop up to the north of Europe and said, right, anybody who eats a horse is not a Christian. You're got to go to hell.
Wow.
You can't do that anymore. And it stayed in place for a long, long time. But then as Catholicism lost its theological hold with the Reformation, more and more Europeans, Italians, French, Belgians, they started consuming horses again until it's now quite common in parts of Europe.
That's amazing. I never...
In fact, that's what happened to the horses in Eastern Europe after the fall of the Soviet Union. Now this is really interesting. Let's talk about, we talk about what horses eat. Let's talk about what humans eat. This
yeah.
is interesting because if you go to Montana, nobody's going to sit down and go, hi, how'd you like to have a pony burger? And you go, what? There's just no way. But in the encyclopedia, I warn people, said, look, where you go is going to influence what you are offered to eat. And a lot of cultures eat horses. Now, for example, in Italy, which, you know, passed this religious taboo against eating horse meat, the Italians actually later have a huge fondness for horse sausage. And so lots of people have told stories about how when the Soviet Union imploded, people rushed in to take advantage of how they could buy up all the military hardware. They even made a movie about that starring Nicolas Cage about some savvy guy who goes in and, you know, he buys jets and tanks and machine guns and makes a lot of money. But only one guy, a British longrunner named Jeremy James, he's the guy who documented how the Italian mafia rushed into the former Soviet Eastern European satellite countries and hoovered up all the horses, because there was horses all over Eastern Europe.
Right.
They had been used in agriculture, and they were owned collectively on the farms. And they suddenly represented a tremendous amount of money. And so they slammed them in trucks and took them to Italy and turned them into sausage and made a lot of money. And basically that was the second big equinocide, and that happened in the 21st century. The first one happened in the early 20th century with the invention of canned dog food.
Yeah, right. Now, we talked about this originally, and now it's more prevalent than before, I guess you could say, or more there's probably more to it than there was when we first talked in 2011. Because in 2011, you just come out with the book, Deadly Equines. And it was already sort of like some pushback, you know, from horse people. So now it's been 7 years. I mean, what's the reaction been from the horse community to what you're saying?
Well, religion and horses have a lot in common. You know, what you're born into is basically what most people stick with what, you know, mom and dad taught them.
Right.
You know, so if you're a gaucho in Argentina, you don't eat horse meat, okay? But if you live on the other side of the Andes and you live in Chile, you eat horse meat, okay? It depends on which side of the mountain you're on, all right?
Yeah.
And so the reaction has been based on which country is responding. Okay, but by and large, people are they're curious, and they're thinking, oh, okay, you know, it's pretty hard to, when you look at, you know, film footage, you know, shot by Nazis in 1938 in Tibet. I mean, I'm not making this up. I mean, you can go on YouTube and look at the film footage, and there's a horse eating this. I mean, you know, that it's just, that's a fact.
Right.
So the original reaction was interesting. I had an exchange with a well-known American equine academic. And she had written a horse book, which was basically a recitation of all the usual stuff. You know how, you know, horses pulled plows and horses pulled chariots and horses were at Waterloo and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I said, look, you know, I'm doing this encyclopedia. And by the way, I got distracted and I got into this dietary aggression thing. And, oh, really? And she was at first really interested. But then when the book came out, I said, you know, I'd like to see the book and share it with you. Okay, fine, no problem. And, you know, she basically, there was a shriek, you know, and I said, well, you know, what's wrong? And it wasn't she didn't believe it. She finally just basically went, yada, 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 yada. I don't want to talk about it because there was the evidence. It's just that it made her so uncomfortable.
Right.
That she just didn't want to continue the conversation. I mean, it's not a comfortable conversation. I mean, you know, we think of horses as being big, lovable, benign creatures, you know. But that's not, you know, they're not always like that. That's just the reality of it.
Right. Exactly. It's so aside from that, but I mean, have you got like hate mail or anything like that, or are people just kind of like they just shut their mind off to it?
No. As a matter of fact, it's a funny thing because we're addressing an American audience. What I've been getting are a lot of fast food stories, and it's like, oh, my horse always ate hamburgers. Oh, my horse loves pizza. You know,
yeah.
And you know, so. So what we have are people who are coming up with more stories, you know. And like I said earlier, I mentioned the Colorado cowboy Harry Gant, and
yeah,
how he was an eyewitness to this terrible savage attack. But Americans also have stories, and they have modern stories about how their horses will nibble on stuff. You know, they come back and their sandwiches are gone. Hey, what the hell happened? Where's my sandwich? Twinkie, you ate my ham sandwich. You can't do that. You're a horse. And Twinkie's got this guilty, you know, look on her face. So I think that's what is that? There hasn't been any concerted, this is ridiculous, this is impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, it can be impossible. You've seen the stuff yourself. I mean, you've seen the photographs I sent you over to today.
Yeah, exactly. It makes, like I said, I mean, when you, like as we've said, you know, if you take a step back, it's really not that radical of an idea, you know.
Well, you know, let me give you a parallel, okay? Now, if I say, you know, we talk again, you know, most people have cell phones. Most people drive in very complicated automobiles nowadays, you know, computerized complicated automobiles. They travel at great speeds, okay? They don't interact with nature very much, okay? If they do interact with nature, then maybe they go to a picnic or they go to a park or whatever. And so their perception of animals itself has changed. And so, you know, I'll take, for example, just one animal that's talked about in the encyclopedia, and that's bears. You know, I warn equestrian explorers. I said, look, man, if you go into bear country, let me tell you how bad it is, and here's why it's so bad, and I explain it all. When you ask most modern people to think about a bear, they usually visualize, like, you know, a teddy bear, or if they're English, they think of Paddington Bear, or they remember the little bedtime story about Winnie the Pooh. But in the encyclopedia, I explain that there's 8 different kind of bears, and that they are really, really widespread. And then I go on to list 5 examples in a row of people in America. John Wallace, 59, he was killed in Yellowstone, 2011. Lana Hollingsworth, killed in Arizona, 2011. Kevin Kammer, killed in 2010. And Montana Harvey, killed by 2005. And Carl Stalker, 28. He was walking with his girlfriend in the hometown in Alaska. A polar bear chased him down, killed him, and consumed him in front of the townspeople.
Oh, Jesus.
So people don't have a problem with polar bears eating you. You know, if you go up to, poor Carl was in Port Lay, Alaska. So, you know, if you happen to find yourself in Port Lay, Alaska, you might want to look up and down the street both ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you see a polar bear coming, you're going to go, hey, my God, that's a polar bear. You know, he ate Carl. He'll eat me.
Right.
You don't have a problem with that. But if you go out to the field and you see a horse, you're not automatically going to make that same assumption. Now, one episode, I don't have this man's name in front of me, but an episode has happened since I last talked to you, and it happened in Tennessee.
Yeah.
And this man drove up to the pasture to pick up his dad. His dad was overdue, and he saw his dad lying in the field, and the horse was standing over him, and he couldn't understand what the horse was holding, and the horse was holding his father's arm.
Ugh.
He had killed the father, and he had torn his arm off.
Oh!
Yes. Now, that has happened since I wrote the book.
Oh,
and,
shit.
There's other examples like that. So, you know, again, this gets back to polar bears in Alaska. You know, no problem. We can accept that. A murderous horse in Tennessee, that's kind of hard for us to put our brains around.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not me, man. This is like we have a guy who's come on and talk about the crazy, the dangerous nature of cruise ships, and I won't even go on a cruise now. And it's like when I see a horse, I'm kind of have the same mindset. I'm like, all right, just be careful around this thing.
No, go ahead.
No, well, I was going to pivot to something else. Not like you were going to talk about what I just said.
No, go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to jump into the wolves part of this conversation because that you said that this is sort of something that's really caught your attention in recent years.
Yeah, well, you know, if I was an Italian Catholic in 732 AD, I wouldn't eat horse meat because that's taboo, right?
Right.
Okay, so you understand the concept of a cultural taboo, don't you?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. All right. Right. So let's go. Let's move into a cultural taboo. Okay. I have to. You got to give me a minute here. Okay?
Yeah. No worries.
I gotta, That's all right. I got to flip over here. And all right. I made a really radical discovery, okay? You have to understand, I don't know anything about bears. You know, I don't go looking for bears. What I'm only interested in equestrian travel. You know, if I want to get on originally I went out to Afghanistan in the 1970s. You know, I wanted to ride across that country. And then later on I rode across Pakistan, you know. And so my focus is always, you know, if I live in Boston, how do I get to San Diego?
Right.
You know, that, you know, how do you do that? And because I went to a classic riding school in England, you know, I thought, you know, knowing how to make a horse go in a perfect figure eight or jump over painted sticks, I thought that was going to help me become an equestrian explorer, and that didn't really help me a whole lot in Afghanistan, if you get where I'm going.
Oh, yeah.
So learning how to tie a turban, that was practical, but knowing dressage didn't help me much. So a lot of the things that I've had to learn have been forced upon me by circumstances. And when I was doing the encyclopedia, one thing would lead to the other. And I would think, oh, okay, well, what about this? This surely this can't take very much time to investigate and, you know, and look into. And so I wanted to warn people in Volume 2 about what I call the challenges. You know, how do you cross a border? You know, what about horse theft?
Yeah.
What about we've already talked about, you know, cultural taboos. What about sexual taboos? You know, well, you know, what about animal attacks? Oh yeah, you know, animals, they attack you and they'll eat you and your horse. I better. So I warn people about that.
What do you mean? Hold on, I gotta stop you here, dude. What do you mean sexual taboos?
Well, you know,
I got a dirty mind, so once I heard that, I gotta ask you what the hell that's about.
You know, I can't come up with an idea right now because I'm thinking about animals, but
yeah.
There is a chapter in the encyclopedia about how it warns people that you have to be aware of the fact that different cultures have different dietary and sexual and religious beliefs and practices.
Okay.
You know, menstruation, sexual aggression, hostility towards men. For example, this isn't sexual, but it's an aggression thing. You know, it talks about in the encyclopedia. I talk about, you know, watering holes. I mean, if you go into the wrong pub in England, you're gonna get the shit beat out of you because you're not from the right neighborhood. You know, it depends on what we're talking about.
Right, I see what you're saying. Okay, all right.
But what happened? You brought up this, and I'm going to go back to this idea of a taboo. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I want to say now is something that is basically got to be one of the biggest taboos in the United States and in Western Europe, and that is the subject of wolves. And before we talk about wolves, we got to talk about insects, okay?
Insects.
Now, I have to tell you that you probably don't realize this, but there's something like 92,000 different kinds of insects.
Yeah, I figured it was I figured it was more than that. But
maybe it's more than that. I mean, but there's just gazillions, 10 zillion of kinds of insects. And
right.
In the encyclopedia, I talk about that. And I also talk about how the common tick is spreading further north because of warmer climates. It's spreading further north.
Yeah,
there's more
that.
Of them. And Lyme disease, which was only recently diagnosed, is becoming much more prevalent. It's spreading further around the world. We're seeing it documented for the first times in Mongolia and Kazakhstan. And long riders are getting Lyme disease while they're traveling. We've had 3 long riders become seriously ill since I spoke to you from Lyme disease, from tick bites. And President George W. Bush got Lyme disease from a tick bite.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about a tick is that nobody ever says they mean you no harm. Are that the tick is a symbol of nature. Okay?
right, yeah.
Okay, I mean, it's a tick.
Right.
Okay, so what does a tick do? A tick crawls up your leg, it bites you on your leg, and it ingests bacteria into your body, and you get really sick, and it's nasty, and that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way nature works. It's not personal. You just happen to be a source of meat that's walking by.
Right. Yeah. It's like, no, it's kind of like, it's kind of like how this, nobody's really like a big fan of like pigeons. You know what I mean? It's like people love birds. Even the, you know, bird, people can, you know, they like birds, but it's like pigeons, no. You know what I mean? Like rats and pigeons and ticks for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't take it. I mean, a pigeon. Look, you know, if you go to St. Mark's Plaza in Venice, it's populated by hundreds, thousands of pigeons. And, you know, some people call them flying rats. Some people hate pigeons.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But lice, pigeons, they don't have that kind of warm attraction for most modern people.
Yeah.
But the wolf has got a different thing going on for it. And what I document in the encyclopedia is an entire chapter about wolf attacks against horses and humans. And what was so surprising to me was, I knew that there's a famous episode of a Romanian long rider who barely escaped being attacked by a wolf pack. He was traveling cross country through a forest in the early 19th century, and he had a revolver and a sword, and he put his horse into a gallop, and it was a near miss, and he got away. And that was the only episode that I knew of. And I thought, well, you know, no, there's no big deal there. I mean, you know, don't bump into wolves. But it's like the dietary evidence. It's something I didn't look for, but the evidence kept mounting and mounting and mounting, and there was more and more of it. And what I discovered was that there wasn't so much evidence of wolves and how they had been misunderstood that I ended up making a separate chapter in the encyclopedia just to warn modern equestrian explorers about how not only did most people misunderstand the potential danger of wolves, but how vast and fast they were moving and spreading across North America and Western Europe. And this has happened with such rapidity that I mean, the chapter in the book in the encyclopedia is going to be released in a couple of weeks, and the chapter's already out of date because the wolf news has moved by that fast.
Yeah. So what have you uncovered about these wolves, though, dude? I mean, how prevalent is this? What should we know? You're trying to warn people.
You can't talk about wolves without talking about Walt Disney.
All right, let's do it.
Okay, because you can't talk about wolves without understanding lemmings, okay? And here's what I discovered. Back in 1958, Walt Disney, the Disney studio, they made a movie called White Wilderness, okay? Now, this movie was supposed to depict an Arctic environment. It was a nature film, okay? And this is the movie that shows the famous footage of lemmings in a migratory wave of lemmings, and they're launching themselves off a cliff into the water below. Do you know about that?
Yeah. I'm familiar with lemmings.
That's fake.
What's that?
I said, that's fake.
Really?
Yeah. The Walt Disney Studio faked the footage, okay? They put up a banner poster saying film at the top of the world, and the film was actually shot near Calgary. And they don't even have any lemmings in Calgary, and there's no outlet to the sea there. And what they did was they hired children to go out and catch lemmings for 25 cents a piece, okay? Then they took them back to Calgary, and what they did was the Disney cameraman placed the captured lemmings on a spinning turntable covered with snow, and then they showed the lemmings being flung into the ocean, being flung into the air. And then what they did was they took to film to capture the lemmings' death scene. The Disney crew deliberately herded the animals off a cliff and showed them falling onto the rocks and drowning in the Bow River. And that's not the Arctic Ocean, as implied by the film.
Yeah.
And so they made this film called White Wilderness, and they actually won an Academy Award for that. Okay? And they made a lot of corporate profit. And that's where they perpetrated the idea that lemmings commit suicide. That's where this came from, okay, from Walt Disney.
Yeah.
Right? And the Walt Disney lemming story is the precedent for a book and a film called Never Cry Wolf. Have you heard that?
No.
So the idea that wolves mean you no harm and that wolves don't eat you, that's recent. Okay.
I don't know who believes that, dude. I wouldn't go anywhere near a wolf. Like that to me, it's like they still seem dangerous to me. I don't know who believes that wolves are mean you no harm.
Well, let me tell you something. If you've ever heard anything that's going to raise controversy on your show, if you say again to the American listeners, you know, I don't think wolves mean me any harm. I mean, you know, this is a lightning rod of a topic. Okay?
Really?
Absolutely. I mean, let me back. Before we talk about what people are like today, let me tell you what happened. Back in 1963, a Canadian named Farley Mowat, M-O-W-A-T, he wrote a book called Never Cry Wolf.
Right.
And he was stationed up in Canada, and he was supposed to monitor wildlife while he was up there. And he's the guy who wrote the story that says, oh, wolves don't hunt down caribou, wolves hunt down mice, okay? And wolves are not as bad as we believe they are. They're actually very nice creatures, and they don't mean this any harm, okay? And so the evidence that wolves were lethal killers was either ignored or replaced in Moffat's book, all right? And this book went on to become a global bestseller. I mean, it's been translated into everything, Japanese, everything. And Disney bought up the rights to the book. Disney made a film called Never Cry Wolf. Disney Studio, again, is the one that perpetrated this animal myth that wolves mean you no harm, okay? And you don't have to be worried about wolves. And it wasn't until the fall of the Soviet Union that an American academic called Dr. Will Graves, he went in and actually studied Russian documents which proved how dangerous wolves were and how the American and Canadian and English conception of wolves had been falsely created by this Hollywood mythology. And what he did was he documented how communism rose to power in connection with an effort to save the peasants from being eaten by wolves.
Huh.
And so this goes back to how dangerous wolves are, and now they have been they're reemerging straight across Europe. The first wolf was recently seen in Lithuania. That was a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
When I finished the wolf chapter in 2013, I had a map of wolf packs who had moved out of Russia. They had come across Germany, but since then they've now reached the Atlantic. And I have photographs of a wolf walking down a main street in a large city in Holland, and they've spread across Europe. And most modern people think that wolves are not any kind of threat. And, of course, that's not the case. No, that's not the case, because in the chapter, I've got a picture here of poor Kenton Carnegie. He was a researcher. He was up in Saskatchewan, and he was killed and eaten in 2005. And here's another photograph. Hang on a second. On the next page of Candace Berner. And she was killed and eaten in March 2010 when she was out jogging. And part of this gets back to another film, Dances with Wolves. Do you remember seeing that movie?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so Captain John Dunbar, Lieutenant John Dunbar, the famous scene where he comes out of the cabin and he holds out the piece of bacon, and the wolf comes up and he eats the bacon from the guy's hand.
Yeah.
So what happens is that wolves are incredible alpha predators, and as they become habituated to humans or human presence, they're really intelligent. And as they lose fear of humans, then they invade their space. And so by feeding that wolf that bacon, what Dunbar was doing was inviting it into his living space. And traditionally, humans knew that if wolves become acclimated to humans, that old people and especially children are put at great risk. So the chapter explains and gives evidence of that. And what it also does is it provides the, I'm sorry to say this, but really gruesome details of how wolves kill horses and other animals. And that's really disturbing, but it's very accurate and unfortunately true.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I always kind of considered horses to be dangerous. I mean, wolves to be dangerous. So to me, it's like...
Wait. I think you're an exception in that. I think if you went around and talked to most Americans would say, no, wolves don't eat people. Wolves don't attack people. Wolves are afraid of people. And,
really? Okay.
That may be based on recent historical evidence, because wolves are smart, and wolves learn from each other. They, you know, they run in packs, okay? And they have incredible sense of smell and hearing. And so they're able to detect prey from a tremendous distance away, and they'll zero in on something. And horses, for example, this is what's so terrible about horses, and this is why it applies to the long rider world, and that is because when the wolf pack starts chasing the horse, they try to jump onto its back, and what they do is they grab it, and then they attack it in its anus, and they start eating it, and the more wolves that pile onto it, they start eating the horse from the rear. And then one wolf darts underneath, and they disembowel the horse, and once the horse is disemboweled, its intestines fall out, then the horse is immobilized, and then the wolf pack comes in, and then they start eating the animal alive.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it's really disgusting.
That's pretty gruesome.
Now, in the chapter, it explains how one of the reasons cowboys used to hate wolves so much was because they do this to cattle, too. They will eat a cow, they'll attack a cow or a horse, and they will bring it down in this really painful, gruesome way. You know, you've heard of wolfing your food? Wolves don't have teeth like lions. They have different kinds of teeth. They take giant chunks and they tear it out. So the victim's literally being torn to pieces.
Jesus.
And so what happens is that the horse is being torn. Pieces of the horse are being torn out. But the horse often lives and is left there immobilized and in incredible agony. And then in the chapter, it gives accounts of cowboys who talk about how they've had to come up and shoot horses that have survived these horrendous attacks. So it's not just people, it's horses and it's other animals. And the other issue that is very seldom ever talked about, it's coming out more and more now, though, is what they call surplus killing. Because if a lion, for example, if a lion hunts down an animal, the pride comes in that surrounds it, and they eat it, okay?
Yeah.
It's like you eating a hamburger. You go to McDonald's, you order a Big Mac, you eat your Big Mac, you get up, you leave, okay? What you don't do is you don't do what's called surplus killing. You don't go into McDonald's and go, right, I want 20 Big Macs, and you put them on the table, and you eat one, and you leave the other ones and walk away. That's
right.
What wolves do. Wolves will kill more animals than they need. They get into a panic, or I won't say
frenzy.
Panic. They go into a frenzy. That's the word. They go into a frenzy, and the evidence on the wolves, like the horse thing, keeps coming in. In 2017, there was evidence in Yellowstone, I think it was, and it showed 17 elk all laid dead. They had all been killed. They hadn't been eaten. They'd all been killed. And last week in France, 32 expensive sheep were killed in the mountains of France. They weren't eaten. They were just killed. And this is the thing about wolves. They present more of a threat than modern humanity understands.
Yeah.
And it's much, much worse than people can really comprehend.
Right, right. I think that's why you're sounding the alarm about this. Now, you say they're spreading, like they made it to the Atlantic?
Spreading is a past tense. It's spread. It is
spread. Ah.
Let me tell you something. I was going to send, maybe if you remember when you first wrote me and said, hey, how about speaking to me again? I sent you a New York Times story about the First World War. Do you remember that?
I don't recall it off the top of my head.
Okay.
I'm not sure if
you
did.
Let me tell you how bad this was.
Come on.
In 1917, the New York, I'm looking at the article. In 1917, the New York Times reported that the fighting between the Germans and the Russians had to be stopped, and they enacted a temporary peace so that the soldiers could jointly defend themselves against wolf packs, which were killing soldiers from both armies.
Oh, wow.
I'm looking at the story right here. And
that's crazy.
What happened was that there were so many wolves in Russia, and people weren't, before the rise of the Bolsheviks, you know, not many people were armed, and a lot of people were living out in the country. A lot of people, especially children, were systematically killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Lenin came to power, he promised, one of his political promises was that he would get the wolves under control. And so when communism became a political force in the Soviet Union, as communism spread, wolf eradication programs spread too. And they employed government hunters that kept wolves under control. But when communism stopped, the hunters were lost their jobs, and then the wolf population exploded.
Wow.
And it not only went through Kazakhstan and Mongolia, it spread all the way across Europe, and now it's reached the Atlantic.
Wow. That's crazy.
Well, there's more wolves now in North America, in the United States. When you and I talked last time, there were, 70,000 wolves in the United States, and I'm sure there's lots more now. And the wolf discussion in the United States is a serious topic of concern. And it's not just between ranchers who have cattle and sheep that are dying painfully. Okay, that's what we have to talk about. We're not talking about a quick kill, a cut across the throat.
Right, right.
People are dying, and people are seeing their beloved animals killed painfully. That's one thing. But we're also talking about an urban view of a wild animal versus a rural view. If you're a French farmer and you've got all these expensive sheep and you walk out and you've got 35 dead sheep, you're out of business.
Right.
And it's emotionally devastating as well as financially devastating. But people are starting to realize that wolves present a potential threat that Hollywood has not accurately depicted.
Well, that's Hollywood for you, right?
Well, yeah. Don't trust them. If they tell you about lemmings or politics or wolves, don't trust them.
That didn't leave much.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So what else is going on with you? We're near the end of the show here, so let's go for like another 10 minutes because we got a late start on things. If you can, you don't mind, right?
No. I think what's interesting, that's also of global importance.
Yeah.
And this is about horses. This show started with horses, so let's end on horses. And you talked about the Long Riders Guild, and I'll tell you briefly about it. The Long Riders Guild started with five equestrian explorers from three countries, and there's now 400 long riders in 46 countries. And there were two equestrian expeditions when the guild started. We've now mentored or supplied or equipped 200 on every continent except Antarctica.
Nice.
And the journeys that are being done they're extraordinary. It went from being on the verge of extinction to becoming an increasing popular thing that just sweeps across borders. It's something that cannot be defined by nationalism, competition, or commercialism.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is that it's a horse and a human on a journey across a different part of the world towards the unknown. And this is so appealing that's why it's growing with such rapidity. There's a fantastic long rider in the saddle right now. His name is Li Jing. And first he made a 9,000-mile solo journey from Russia across Siberia down to Peking. And then he made a 3,000-mile ride along the Great Wall of China. And now he's on a 5,000-mile ride across Russia to the Arctic Circle.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So that's happening right now. But since you and I talked, Philippe Lightday rode 14,000 miles from Canada to the end of Patagonia. And like I said, Bernice Indy, she rode to ocean in both directions. And it's not just the mileage. You know, this riding a horse isn't like an odometer. You know, it's not like your car.
Right.
when you're in this steel cocoon, you go flying through, and you know, you don't smell anything, you don't interact with nature. But when you're on a horse at 3 miles an hour, you're really out there. And this is appealing more and more to younger and younger people. And so with the release of first the Horse Travel Handbook, that's the small cavalry-style manual that I finished, that's being read around the world and it's being taken on journeys, you know, just on every continent.
Yeah.
And now the big encyclopedia is coming out. So we're going to have an even larger movement in that.
Well, Beagle, what's the website so folks can find out more about your stuff? Longridersguild.com?
www.thelongridersguild.com. The Guild is the repository of the largest collection of equestrian travel information in history, and it's all free. And there's a special page which talks about how we don't interact with Facebook or social media, and we don't take people's – we don't use cookies. And it's one of the pioneering websites. It's a vision of what Sir Tim Berners-Lee thought the Internet was going to be like. It's not commercial. It's about sharing important information for free with people who are desperate to learn.
Hey, that could be the motto for our show, man. Yeah, free free stuff, free material, you know, for people that are trying to learn. And, you know, that's what we've been doing all these years. So.
Well, I think you've done a tremendous positive good thing to help people by exposing them to all this important information. And I think that, you know, you can look back with pride on all the shows that you've done. And I'm really grateful to you personally for having given us or given me the opportunity to share this with people.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it. And, you know, it's been a wild ride. And like I said, everybody, so many people say they just mention the meat-eating horses because it completely, like, you know, it changed their whole perspective on things. Because it really is one of those things that you just don't, unless someone introduces the idea to you, it just doesn't cross your mind at all. It's really an amazing sort of phenomenon in a sense.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Tim, for sharing it with your listeners and for giving it. I mean, this is a global situation with important history, and I think that you've done a tremendous service for everybody.
No, thank you very much. All right, longridersguild.com is the website. Thanks for coming back on the show, Cullen, and best of luck on your next ride.
All right, talk to you soon. Ciao.
Have a good night.
Bye.
There you go, folks. That was Cullen O'Reilly talking about meat-eating and murderous horses, and also wolves. I thought wolves were already dangerous. I don't know. I'm a little confused about that because I would like to hear from the listeners on this one. So on Facebook or email or whatever, you let me know because I was under the impression that that wolves were dangerous. I wouldn't be going near a wolf. I just assumed they would hurt me. So, but maybe I'm in the minority. I don't know. That's what Cullen seemed to suggest. Yeah, so as I said at the beginning of the show, this is the last long-form conversation we're going to do here on Season 10. And now it's time, I guess you could say, for the finale, the big end show. As we wrap up Season 10, we're going to wrap up Banal of America in the seasonal format. This is sort of the big culmination program that it's been a real – I guess I'll talk more about it when we do the show. But, it's you know, it's been – I wanted to really stick the landing on this one, folks. I wanted to make sure that we went out in a way that that sort of captured the spirit of Banal of America at its core. So – with that in mind, I'm announcing now here for all of you that the season finale of Banal of America Audio Season 10, and I guess you could say for now the series finale, will be coming at you this coming Sunday. So we're only a few days away now, folks. This coming Sunday, April 22nd, it's going to be live from New Orleans, Louisiana. I'll be down there for Paramania 3. And we've gone the extra mile on this one, folks. We've rented the courtyard of a occult bookstore. Let me get the name here for you so I can really really get you all the. I should have been better prepared for this. Let me see. All right, almost there. There we go. Okay. We're going to be coming at you live from the courtyard of the Starling Magical Occult Shop, located in the French Quarter of New Orleans, this coming Sunday, live on the internet from 7 p.m. to, no, an hour back. Yeah, so let me see. From 5 to 7 p.m. There you go. No, I'm wrong. Jesus. This is what happens when I get up at 9 o'clock in the morning to do a show. No, it's going to be from 5 to 7 p.m. 5 to 7 p.m. because I'm looking at it here. I have it on East Coast time. We're going to be... God damn you, Benal. It's 7 to 9 p.m. 7 to 9 p.m. because they're, New Orleans is Central time. I'm looking at the East Coast time. Or at least I'm looking at local time on here. So an hour further ahead. So 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern time. Live from New Orleans, the Starling Magical Occult Bookshop. As I said, I'm going to be down in New Orleans for Paramania, which is the big gathering of friends and compatriots and fellow travelers in the world of the paranormal. It's kind of like an underground secret meetup thing we do every year. And since I'm going to be down in New Orleans, and we were looking for sort of the best way to wrap this up, it all kind of came together, and I was like, let's do it. Let's do a live show from New Orleans, you know, a big fucking party, man. That's what it's going to be. It's going to be a big party. And Greg Bishop's going to be there. Joshua Cutchin's going to be there. Miguel Romero, Red Pill Junkie, he's going to be there. Steve Ray is going to be there. Some folks may remember Steve. He's called in a few times on the show. Plus a whole bunch of listeners of Benal of America. So it's like just going to be a big celebration and sort of a jam session live in the courtyard of an occult bookshop. I mean, how crazy is that? How, you know, that's as bombastic an ending as I could possibly come up with, I think. You know, a live show from New Orleans in the courtyard of an occult bookshop, the Starling Magical Occult Shop in the French Quarter. So we're going to be right in the French Quarter on Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, wrapping up BOA Audio Season 10, wrapping up in All of America Audio, the seasonal style, taking a break after that, obviously. So it's the big finale, folks. And it's going to be huge, and that's about it. And people, I hope, folks will call in. We'll get a phone number for it so people can call in if they want. And, that's about it. So that's this coming Sunday, April 22nd, 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern time. And we'll have the links up in all of America. It's going to be – I'm warning you now. We're going to be broadcasting from the courtyard of an occult bookshop in New Orleans. I don't know what the fuck could go wrong. This could go completely haywire. You know, we could be sitting there going, shit, we can't connect to this thing. God bless him, Greg Bishop. He's done these live shots before. We did one in Halifax a couple of years ago. So we know it can be done, and we're kind of working out the details. And I'm hoping to just have a direct link from Benal of America right to the stream that you'll be able to click on at 7 p.m. on Sunday. But like I said, who knows? Who knows what could go wrong? Something could go wrong. But no matter what, we'll record it. So the festivities will be recorded. But I'd say I'm like 95% positive we'll be able to pull off the live thing. But I'm warning you now that you never know what might go wrong. But I mean, at worst case scenario, I guess I could fire up the blog talk and get us live on there. So I mean, we're going to be live. And at the same time, while we're live, we're also it's going to be – hopefully you'll be able to get it right through Benal of America. And also Smiles Lewis of the Anomaly Radio Network is also going to simulcast the live finale on the Anomaly Radio Network. So there should be a bunch of different ways for people to listen. I don't want to overhype it because it's just going to be kind of us hanging out, talking – reflecting on the show, shooting the shit, hopefully get some calls in from folks who've been on the show in the past and talk a little bit about, the legacy of this program. So that's it. And all while sitting in the courtyard of an occult bookshop in New Orleans in the French Quarter. So I can't think of a crazier way to wrap it up than that. So on that note, thank you all for tuning in, and you'll be hearing from me in, you know, 5 days, 6 days or so, this coming Sunday, live from New Orleans. How many times am I going to say it? How many times are you going to say it? But I'll live from New Orleans, the courtyard of the Starling Magical Occult Shop in the French Quarter, 7 to 9 p.m., the big Banal of America finale. This is it. So tune in, and I'll still be on vacation after that. I'm such a dick. Yeah, so after the toys, you're probably going to have, if you don't tune in live, there's a good chance this thing's not going to be on the podcast feed for at least until the Friday after the episode. So, you know, you're going to be waiting like 5 days to hear the show if you don't tune in live, because I'm going to still be on vacation until I get back on Friday. So once I get back on Friday, I'll flip the episode and get it on the podcast feed. But, so that's it. So you really want to tune in live, and you want to, you'll be able to get the link through Banal of America. I'm going to try, I have to get that set up before I leave for New Orleans on Thursday. So check that out. And once again, thanks for tuning into the show. Thanks again to Colin O'Reilly. And on that note, I'll be talking to you on Sunday live from New Orleans.